The Gospels, a commentary. Professor Anthony Frendel and Professor Peter Bassallo discuss excerpts from the Gospels. Readings by Patricia Camilleri. A reading from Luke, chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. He spoke the following parable to some people who prided themselves on being virtuous and despised everyone else. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood there and said this prayer to himself, "I thank you, God, that I am not grasping, unjust, adulterous like the rest of mankind, and particularly that I am not like this tax collector here. I fast twice a week, I pay tithes on all I get." The tax collector stood some distance away, not daring even to raise his eyes to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, "God be merciful to me, a sinner." This man, I tell you, went home again at rights with God. The other did not. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the man who humbles himself will be exalted.
Today, Peter, we have a different story here, which is a parable, obviously, narrated by Jesus to teach something, and I would like to introduce our conversation by some textual and historical notes. The first point, perhaps, to take note of by way of background, is the fact that the first verse seems to be inserted by Luke, introducing Jesus' story. So Luke already gives us the summary when he says, "He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt." The rest is Jesus' narrative relayed by Luke. The first point to keep in mind is that this is a parable, and usually in the New Testament, from the literary point of view, let's say, much has been discussed about the distinction between an allegory and a parable. And although there might be some debate on certain points, in a nutshell, a parable has one punchline, no matter how long or short the story is. Whereas an allegory, as everybody knows, is a story where each section has to be symbolized and has to mean something else. So it's useless to ask who's who is representing what in a parable. There is one punchline, and the punchline in this story seems to be the very end, explicitated by Jesus himself. "He who exalts himself will be humbled, and all who humble themselves will be exalted." Now, the Pharisees. I think in order start our conversation, we might remember that, unfortunately, we come with a lot of a priori views about who the Pharisees were. The Pharisees got a lot of bad press, and that's fair enough, because they also had a lot of conflict with Jesus. But all in all, Jesus himself would have obviously endorsed many tenets of the Pharisees, not all, as we know. And here we have their one weak point. Well, who were the Pharisees? Historically, the Pharisees were a group of pious Jews who separated themselves from the rest of the community during the Hellenistic period, more precisely during the Maccabean Wars and thereafter, because they thought that most of the Jews were mingling too much with the Gentiles, in this case with the Greeks, and that they were taking too many customs from the Hellenistic Greeks. And so they separated themselves and became the observant ones, the pious ones. Pharisees, in fact, which comes from the Greek word pharisaio, pharisaioi, which in turn comes from a Hebrew word, parash, to separate oneself, to stand apart. So they are those who stood apart. And historically, the Pharisees wanted to study the law, they wanted to teach, they wanted to observe the law, they endorsed the written law and the oral law. And by the time of Jesus, actually, they stood well in the eyes of people. So what we should do in order to discuss the story is to appreciate the fact that the listeners of Jesus would have come historically at that time with an a priori favorable attitude to the Pharisees. And Jesus is trying to turn the tables around, underscoring their one major weak point, which we can discuss, which is the point of the parable. I don't know that that can introduce our discussion, and then we'll discuss further historical details later on.
There are two, it seems to me, versions of the Pharisees that one can glean from the Gospels. One is, as you're saying, that they are traditional, that they keep to the religion. The law of Moses, I suppose, was sacrosanct for
them. That's it, untouchable.
And the letter of the law, more than anything else. And therefore they were the guardians, the custodians of the truth, and of not only religious, but I think of the identity of the Jew. Because, in fact, as you were saying, if the word comes from those who keep themselves apart, they kept themselves apart because they didn't want to be involved with the Gentiles. They didn't want to be in some kind of collaboration or collusion with Hellenistic culture and ideas. Therefore, they kept the Jewishness of the Jews, and they were a kind of repository of the Jewishness of the Jews. That is one version that seems to come from a reading such as the one you've just given us. And I think, yes, it's true, it's like that. But very often in the Gospels, you have Christ being very strongly anti-pharisaical. Well, the word Pharisees now seems to me to be hypocrite.
That's the modern English semantics of it.
Yes, in fact, if I may say this in brackets, like the word, for example, for hypocrite in Spanish used to be jesuita. Mm-hmm. The Jesuits were a band of commanders of Christ, but somehow they came to be associated with hypocrisy.
And in English it's jesuitical, I think.
Isn't it? Jesuitical, yeah. Yes. And especially with this kind of double meaning, sophistry. So you've got that sense too. And I think that Christ is really emphasizing here, obviously, the self-righteousness. Because when you are very involved in your religion, when you think that you are the custodian, you have this empowers you. And they had power over the people, because after all, they had power over the people's minds. If you can tell somebody what to think, what is good and what isn't, what is righteous and what isn't, what belongs to Moses and what belongs elsewhere, then I think that this is their way of having power over the people. And Christ is quietly dismantling this.
I agree. I thoroughly agree. In fact, that's it. In fact, as we come closer to look a bit closer at the story, in fact, the Pharisee, from the, let's say, material, physical point of view, he did nothing wrong. On the contrary, he did things which were considered in Jewish tradition to be holy and wholesome, such as paying the tithes, not committing adultery, not stealing, fasting twice a week. But there was one major weak point, and that's what Christ concentrates on, and this is the one you mentioned, this self-righteousness. If I may put it this way, I think everything was right with the Pharisee except one essential thing. He forgot that the source of his righteousness was God.
Yes.
And that is that's where Christ, I think, that's why Christ set up the story. By way of background, before we get once again onto this topic of righteousness, the Pharisee was in fact doing more than the old Torah prescribed. For example, in Jewish tradition, as far as fasting goes, there was a yearly annual fast on the Day of Atonement, the famous Yom Kippur, which still exists. There was a fasting on the during the days of Purim, and there were some other fast days. But by the time of Christ, there was the practice also of fasting, the possibility of fasting twice a week. And this is reflected even in rabbinical literature. Now, the point is, therefore, that the Pharisee wasn't doing anything wrong. But he was doing the worst thing which could be done, appropriating his good acts as if they stemmed from his own power and from his own will rather than from the grace of God. And I think this is the punchline at the end. I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other. And this word just... Now we've got a problem here, because are we... Well, I think we are allowed... First of all, we're obliged, I think, to discuss the story on its own merits, as it stands on its own two feet. But since the biblical texts were expanded, and this story happens to be found in the New Testament, and therefore it forms part, let's say, a sub book within a big book, which a community decided, where I think we are allowed to make intertextual comments. Not everybody would agree on this, but I think we are allowed. And I think if we remember that the Gospel of Luke would have been written much, much later, about 30 years after St. Paul wrote his letter to the Galatians, where he picks up this topic of righteousness and justification, and Luke, we know, was a companion of Paul, Luke, in fact, cherished this parable. He's the only one who relates this. This is a historical parable narrated by Jesus himself. But he picked on it in the tradition and relayed it in a written form, because this was a crucial topic, whether justification comes by the works of the law or by faith. And St. Paul, who was himself originally a Pharisee, born of Pharisees, opts for justification by faith, which doesn't mean that one does not do the law, but it means that one is obliged to realize that the acts of the law which he or she performs are a result of God's own gift. And this is the nutshell, because justification in a nutshell means friendship with God.
So when it really says, and he goes back home or leaves the place of worship more justified than the other, again, it's not entirely, it seems to me not entirely clear, because I imagine that justified would be sort of seeking a kind of in a position to seek a kind of mercy which would normally be given to sinners.
That's it.
And there's a correlation with justice. Justice would have been done to him much more than would be done to the other.
Exactly. In fact, this you've just mentioned something which we've got to go back, I think, to the Old Testament background to understand this. Righteousness, or let's say justification, more or less, they are semantically on the same level in the biblical literature. There is a big difference between righteousness, the meaning of righteousness in the Old Testament, and the meaning of righteousness in the New Testament. And this is a semantic change which Paul induced, in fact. He was the brains behind it. Christ said it, but Paul was the intellectual reflecting on Christ's message. In the Old Testament, to be justified or to be righteous had a legal implication, as you imply, which simply meant that let's say a judge or somebody, declares the state of being in which you are. You're either righteous or unrighteous. It's a declaration.
Yeah.
It's a declaration. This chap is innocent or this chap is guilty. It's simply on the level of, on the verbal level. In the New Testament, St. Paul shifts the meaning on the basis of Christ's own teaching, and justification now becomes something which is, God not only declares you to be so and so, but he makes you so. So he declares you to be just, and whilst he makes that declaration, he makes you so, which means it's a gift of friendship with God. It's not my own effort. It's a bit subtle, but that's the meaning behind it. And I think you've mentioned something very important, Peter, here, when you said, you used the word, perhaps semi-consciously, of more justified. Now, the original Greek text in this parable lends itself to an option. We can either translate, this man went down to his home justified more than the other, or we can translate, grammatically they're both possible, rather than. And in the parable, it seems that the context would have us prefer rather than. In other words, the Pharisee did everything right, everything was materially correct, but he cut off the main lifeline, namely the fact that he did not realize that God was the source of his well-being.
And because he's doing things according to the laws of his religion, following his religion to the letter, makes him feel superior to anybody else.
That's the main point, I think.
Because when you start feeling superior to somebody else, there is a kind of pride, isn't there?
That is it. And I think you've hit the nail on the head by mentioning this somebody else. The whole point here is, the Pharisee loses everything precisely because of what you've mentioned, this last bit, this relationship with others. He was on the right track of doing things, which in fact are good. But as soon as he started comparing himself to others, and looking down on others and despising them, he cut off the grace which he had received.
Yeah. This is the kind of attitude which the Scottish poet Robbie Burns satirizes in his splendid poem, Holy Willie's Prayer, when Holy Willie prays to God and says, oh, thank you, Lord, for not making... He's a Calvinist.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and he feels that only a few are going to be elect. And people like him, only him, are going to be saved.
He's
and he thanks Lord for making him one of them.
That is it.
And Burns really satirizes it.
That's a
very fine poem, very clever.
I think that is the same attitude. And the other thing is, which actually builds on what you're saying, if we look closely at the prayer, it's deceptive here, because the Pharisee thanked God, actually. He said, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people. This is the second bit which goes wrong. It's not the thankful bit. That's fine. That's in fact as it should be, that I'm not like other people. There he's cut off the first bit. And the distinction is with the tax collector. He beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. This echoes, obviously, Psalm 51, the Miserere.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised that the tax collector would be reciting, would have recited part of that prayer. It is this absolute dependence on God. And I think this is what makes a distinction between a Christian and a non-Christian at the end of the day. Not in name, but in reality. Yeah. I mean, because you can get a Christian who doesn't live up to his reality. I think the ultimate would be this, that one... really humbles himself in the authentic sense, not a type of funny, fuzzy type of humility, the truth,
yes.
The truth, self-acceptance, mm-hmm. in front of God's reality. And that is that one has to understand, I think, what Jesus is implying in the story, which he invents in order to teach a lesson. Namely, that everything worthy of being labeled as good, including religious piety, is the fruit of God's own free gift.
Yeah.
If we eliminate the word free, we're back in the Pharisee. And I think on the practical level, this is very difficult to practice.
Yes.
To understand that we are justified by gift, by free gift.
Because really and truly, the person who is respected, the Pharisee, is here being placed in a position of, a difficult position, because he's now no longer being totally disregarded as virtuous as all that. His very virtue is being undermined by his own self-righteousness.
That is it.
Whereas the tax collector, who would have been a symbol of opprobrium among the Jews...
And despised. By
and
them.
Despised. The respected man is somewhat downgraded. And is placed further up in the divine scheme of things.
Exactly.
Because Christ is trying to say now, there is the law of Moses, and they're represented by the Pharisee, but there is another law which goes beyond that, and which is his way of judgment, God's way of judgment. But what I find intriguing in this parable is the fact, this paradox, which I find extremely difficult to understand. But when you read the life of some saints, you realize, for example, that good men and saintly men and pious men, in the best sense of the word, have felt a kind of coolness in relationship to God sometimes, which is exemplified in, for example, in Gerard Manley Hopkins's why do sinners' ways prosper, and why must disappointment all I endeavor end? And he says, you know, he feels barren inside him. Birds build, but not I. Sent by roots rain, O Lord.
This is
then.
Here's a
holy man, a good man, feeling himself barren. And yet, the paradox really is that the sinner is always closer to God.
Mm-hmm.
I find to be honest, in my own way, I take it from my own personal experience, I find that sometimes when one is feeling sort of virtuous and goes to the seven churches and to communion and so on, it's true, you do feel this strength.
Satisfied.
You feel satisfied. But... somehow, when you feel you've gone astray, you've done something you should have done, and you are repentant, and he's have mercy on me, Lord, mm-hmm. then you feel a much closer bond with God.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very... It's something in the French literature, Charles Peggy have said this.
It's a paradox.
Yes, it's a paradox.
But it's obviously true. And I think the reason for it lies... In the basic meaning of the parable, that the experience which you've described is true, I think, because on the lines of this parable, when one is virtuous, in inverted commas, one in fact feels less close to God than a repentant sinner, for the simple reason of not remembering, it's a question of remembering or being conscious of, that very righteousness, virtue, etc., is constantly, literally, a free gift.
Yeah.
And it's that which we forget, and that perhaps helps us to remind us. And in reality, both the virtuous one and the sinner are on the same level.
Yeah.
Because I think it was St. Augustine who said, there go I, Lord, were it not for your grace. In other words, I would have been like,
there
go I. And on these lines, perhaps, you mentioned famous poets, and we could mention also Augustine as a great literary man.
Of course.
He hit it on the head when he said, perhaps he paraphrased this parable, when he said, God considers, he said in Latin, I saw it in a quotation, quis, referring to God, merita nostra velit esse, qued dona ipsius sunt. He wanted to be counted as our merit, in inverted comma, that which is in fact is his own gift. In other words, even merits are a gift.
Yeah.
And it's Paul, I think, who said, what do you have which you have not received?
Yeah.
And this tallies with what you were saying, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
And from the literary point of view, we have a reversal of roles here. We started off the story, the narrative audience thought the parable was in high esteem and the tax collector was despised. That's the narrative audience. At the end, the narrative audience itself is led to understand that God estimates things differently. I know how you think about
it. You can see
that.
Why the Pharisees then grew to dislike Christ so much.
Exactly.
Because he was subverting
That's it.
All they stood for.
By saying the truth.
By saying the truth.
That was Professor Anthony Frindall and Professor Peter Barsalo discussing the gospel passage chosen for today's commentary.